Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, it's episode 385. We preview the April 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember that Retinal Physician is published online at retinalphysician.com and in print. This issue talks about the hot topic in retina. We've talked about it quite a bit, but different angles approaching the psychology and the realities of applying geographic atrophy intravitreal treatment in the office in combination with the other treatments we do. We also talk about some other subjects, including really interesting subject about antisepsis for intravitreal injection, which leads to a wide discussion between all the contributors about the different sort of nuances and things that people do and the different practice patterns exist and how much evidence exists for those practice patterns. Remember, you can find a list of relevant financial disclosures in the episode description. And remember, listeners, we're doing all sorts of new things. You know, one of the big projects we're going to be working on, you're going to notice, is we are going to start having some industry friends as sponsors for episodes. And the reason is we really want to use this podcast to leverage and create opportunities for students to attend meetings throughout the retina calendar. Our goal is to aim to fund at least two or three students to attend VBS 2024 in Miami. That will be in the spring. And so to that end, we have industry partners who are working with us and helping us out. So I want to talk a little bit about EyePoint. EyePoint's a company I've consulted for. And EyePoint currently has one product in the retina space, which is YUTIQ, which is a long-lasting fluocinolone implant, and that lasts out to about 3 years. Remember, this is a low-dose steroid. So again, this is just my opinion, but really best for long-term maintenance of patients with cystoid macular edema, intraocular inflammation, and persistent need for intravitreal steroid therapy to control their CME. I think a lot of us as retina specialists, unfortunately, we take care of post-surgical patients with chronic inflammation and CME, and this can be a reasonable way to try to get extended control and avoid frequent injections. So if you haven't used YUTIQ, you want to learn more, you can always check it out at YUTIQ.com. That's YUTIQ.com, or talk to your local EyePoint rep. Without further ado, here's the April 23 edition of Retinal Physician Previewed.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the April 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, you can find Retinal Physician online and in print. It's found online at retinalphysician.com for free. And joining me for this episode, three of my colleagues from around the country. In alphabetical order, Dr. Safa Rahmani is in Chicago, Illinois. Safa, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Dr. Priya Vakaria is in Tampa, Florida.
Hi, Jay. Good to see you again.
And making sure that Priya, Safa, and I aren't the last in the alphabet, our token Z, Dr. Sarwar Zahid from New York City, New York. Sarwar, welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Well, it's great to be back.
Thank you all for being here. So remember, these articles are available online, so you don't need to, we're not going to go through them in exhaustive detail. If you want to read them, you can go find them. But we're going to talk about four different articles, and there's sort of a theme. I think that geographic atrophy is a hot topic. I think we've talked about it a lot on this program, and yet it seems the more we talk about it, the more people ask about it. I feel I got more questions about GA on a daily basis from colleagues, anterior segment colleagues especially, asking me a lot of questions. And so we have a couple articles about that. So one of them is more more practical, and one is more psychological, right? We've talked a lot about the medical side. And this is an article written by Yingna Liu and Roger Goldberg out of San Francisco, where they talk about retina clinic considerations in the era of treatment for advanced dry AMD, with the subtitle, practices can make a number of adjustments to prepare for a new therapy. And so they talk about some basic things. They do talk about the prevalence. They talk about Syfovre being approved, Zimura up for approval potentially later this year in 2023. And then they talk about how are you going to sort of get these patients in. And they talk about sort of ideas for existing patients, for patients who are getting referred by referring doctors, what sort of things are you going to do in terms of clinic flow, and then the idea of sort of creating a database, and then sort of how do you go through your treatment strategy monthly versus every month, every other month, et cetera. Rather than belabor all this, I think people can go read this, Priya. If you had to sort of pick, was there anything you read from this list that you like, you know, that's a really good thought, or something that I'd like to incorporate in my practice that stood out to you?
Actually, I've also noticed this with other patients that have come to me, but I've had a lot of patients
come with mailers from their doctor saying, hey, there's a new treatment available. Maybe ask us about it. And I never actually thought that would work. And the authors here kind of talk about that as well. And I think that kind of struck a chord with me because I'm seeing it in real life. I'm seeing patients come in with these letters, maybe from a separate retina specialist. You know, we have a lot of snowbirds in Florida. So perhaps their retina specialist up north sent them a letter. And I think that's been really powerful to having some of these patients come in. And again, the biggest thing is we just want to have a conversation with these patients. And I think, as we'll probably get into later, Jay, I don't know that we all agree on which patients should be treated, but I think a conversation is what's warranted. And that's really helping patients come in for that conversation.
Yeah, I like that. You know, the idea of mailers is an interesting one. Like you said, patients are old school who have macular degeneration, right? They still check their mail and they like to get those things in the mail. They're probably not on Sarwar's Insta seeing what he's posting about. So Sarwar, you're in solo practice. It's funny because no one's doing that. I mean, you can say it's a business model, but everything's a business model, I guess. But I don't feel like most retina doctors are like, oh, I need to get more patients. Let me go find some GA patients. It's more the public education part of it, right? To make sure that patients who could be good candidates and who have been sort of maybe lost in the shuffle are obtained. Now, obviously, the companies that make these drugs, especially Apellis and Iveric, they're incentivized to want providers to go find these patients, right? So they're going to talk a lot about this public education. It's dually beneficial. They're educating people and getting patients who may benefit, but they also want to increase the revenue output. But from a retina standpoint, from an education and not losing these patients standpoint, for your New York patients, anything from a strategy standpoint besides what Priya said stand out to you? Is it more about like mining your own patients to make sure you're not missing someone if you're a big retina practice? Is it more about that education of optometrists or ophthalmologists? What do you think is the highest yield way to sort of make sure no one's lost in the shuffle?
That's a great question. I mean, I think what Priya mentioned about mailers and, you know, what you mentioned about the generation of patients that we're taking care of is very important to consider. I mean, that's why I think, you know, the mailers may work, whereas in our generation, we may, you know, send a text blast to all the ICD-10 perifoveal sparing, you know, GA patients. But I think for me personally, my GA population is quite small. So what I've been doing over the last 6 to 9 months is, you know, sort of keeping a list of these patients and reminding them that, hey, by the way, just so you know, there's something in the pipeline. So I'm going to see you a bit sooner than I normally would so we can have this conversation once this drug is approved. So that's what I've been doing personally. But a lot of it is, you know, what Apellis is doing. And I know they've been doing a lot of talks for community doctors, optometrists, and I know the marketing blitz, you know, on TV with the TV commercials is going to come soon. And I've seen some in print ads, you know, in some of our journals and publications as well. But I think the biggest way, you know, I mean, as retina specialists, we're fortunate that we get patients referred to us because, you know, everybody has a retina and there's a lot of people with retinal issues. But I think educating our colleagues is going to be a big part of it, at least for me. I'm opening my new practice now. So it's an interesting time to open a new practice because normally I, you know, mention my interest in, you know, diabetic retinopathy, you know, different surgical interventions, secondary IOLs. But now as I'm marketing my practice, like, hey, send patients to me. It's like, hey, by the way, you know, to optometrists that I go out and meet and general ophthalmologists I go out and meet, I mentioned, you know, but, you know, just, I'm sure you've heard, you know, there's these new medication available, you know, we'll have a J code some point soon. So it, just putting this on the radar of our referring doctors is going to be huge. And also, you know, this article makes a pretty important point that for our patients that have, that we're already treating, you know, they're, you know, that we're seeing them, you know, every, you know, 1 to 2 months or 3 months, if we're able to extend them, look at the other eye, as we already do. I mean, just today, you know, I was injecting the right eye of a patient. And I guess, you know, I hadn't looked at the other eye in a couple of months, but now that, you know, we had this drug approved in the last couple of months, I look at the other, I was like, oh, wow, there's a couple of islands of geographic atrophy in the red-free. Let me take a look at that eye. And then I, you know, at least started that conversation about injecting the eye of this patient that has never received an injection. So I think that's a big source for us as well.
Yeah, great points. And a great point about the fellow eye. And that goes back to flow, Safa. Like, I did clinic today and it wasn't like a crazy busy clinic and I kind of enjoyed it because I actually had time to talk to people and sit and not just be click, 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 click through the EMR. But I had a few patients, probably like 6 or 7 who had questions about Syfovre and GA treatments. And it takes time. Like we've talked about on this podcast before, this is a chair time thing. You're going to have to sit and have chair time. And, you know, it brought up the idea in my mind again is like, how many people are going to give that chair time, right? And how many people are going to, how are people going to do this, right? So like, if you had to guess, do you think most people like are just going to go monthly for, are they going to do monthly? Are they going to do monthly loading doses in every other month, even though there's no data on that? Like what do you think people are going to do when you sort of read the tea leaves of your colleagues in Chicago or other people you've talked to?
I think clinic flow and adding these patients is going to be a logistical challenge, especially in some of the bigger academic centers that, you know, don't have enough staff at this point to get everybody in a timely fashion with their injection protocols and everything. For me, I think that's actually a big challenge in terms of who am I going to choose? How am I going to bring these patients in? If it's going to double my injections, then that's a big technician and chair time, even besides the actual conversation. And to kind of piggyback what others said about the brochures, I think that really can help focus the conversations that we need to have to the pertinence to that patient and the residual questions. Because again, this is not a drug that can improve vision. That's a very hard sell. So, you know, when you say reduction, it's a topic that I think a lot of patients may not really quite understand, and sort of giving multiple, I don't think it'll be one conversation, honestly. I think it'll be multiple conversations before, you know, patients are on board and truly understand, you know, what this means. I hope that people don't deviate too much from protocol this early on, you know, to go loading dose and then, you know, treat it like anti-VEGF. I hope that we, you know, we pick a protocol and stick to it for the patient, for the right patient, but I'm sure it'll happen because that's what the real world is. And, you know, depending on resources and time, people are going to, you know, try to deviate, but I think it's too early to even do that.
Yeah. You know, this kind of ties into the next article. Again, it's not really a separate conversation, but there's another article by Dave Boyer and co-authors where they talk about, they call it the connecting with patients about geographic atrophy. Dave Boyer wrote this, and again, it goes through some of the same stuff. How do you connect these patients? The conversation is going to take time. The hearing SAPA, it's not going to improve vision. It's going to be preventative. I feel like we're going to keep saying that over and over and over again. It doesn't improve vision. And then someone's going to ask you, does it improve vision? And you're going to be like, it doesn't improve vision. And then, you know, injection fatigue is something they talk about there, right? Because you don't have that sort of apple and you feel like you're getting worse over time. And I don't know. I see this with patients today, Priya, with wet AMD. I have some patients who swear that it was this drug or that drug that gave them a bad infect, and therefore they don't want to get Avastin or Lucentis or Eylea or Vabysmo or whatever drug it was, because they had a bad experience because their vision got worse. But it could be for a number of reasons not related to the drug. And usually, look, we lean into it. You say, okay, we don't have to use that drug. We have a lot of other great options. You kind of move away. But patients are going to feel worse while getting this treatment. And they may blame their physician if they feel their physician was rough, or they feel that the process was painful, or they might say, well, it wasn't, you know. So this is like going to be a very interesting sort of minefield for a lot of retina specialists who don't necessarily want to have those conversations or kind of talk to patients about this. I think, again, I think the hard part is, I feel like there's two types of retina specialists, not to be binary, and we're all kind of in between. There's the very optimistic retina specialist who's like, if I explain everything to someone, they'll understand it. And then we've all heard at least one person in our department or institution, sort of the pessimistic retina specialist, who's like, it doesn't matter how many times you tell them, they're not going to listen to you, and they're still going to have expectations. And therefore, they use that as justification to not have that conversation with people. But there will be some people, and this is hard. It's human nature to be like, yeah, they're saying that, but in the back of their head, they're still optimistic that it's going to make me better. I mean, do you have any sort of other strategies to sort of get that home, drive that point home, so people don't end up disappointed?
I think this is really hard. I think a couple of things that I'll probably do. You know, I've only injected one patient so far with atrophy, but I think a couple
only
of
one?
Things that I'll probably do. One so far, yeah.
Only one. Were you the first person in your building to inject Syfovre?
Oh no, that was definitely.
And were you humbled and honored to be the first person to inject Syfovre in your building?
In my building? Yes. In my building. Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
Sorry. I just felt like social media was inundated and it wasn't you, but I felt like every other person was saying like they're the first, and it just kept getting more and more and more narrow. It was like, I'm the first person in the country. I'm the first person in the state. I'm the first person.
I'm the first
in the
person
city.
In my zip code.
Well, Star Wars said he was the first person in his practice to do it, and he's in a solo practice. So that was when I knew they had jumped the shark. Sorry, I didn't actually say that. I'm sorry. But keep going. Sorry.
Well, so, you know, it's hard. You know, I think that what Safa said is true. I don't think these are patients that just come in like our wet AMD patients and we see them and we inject. I think there really has to be patient buy-in. I think the patient really has to understand what they're signing up for. Because remember, if a patient does 3 injections and then stops, they're not going to really have any benefit. The biggest benefit we think of these treatments is at the end of year 2. And so you really need that patient buy-in, you need patient compliance, and then you need them to understand that there's risks and that they're not going to have improved vision. And that's really hard for them to understand when they're first meeting you. So I think the first thing, you know, that I'm going to probably put into practice is talking to patients about it, probably putting this all down in written format, giving it to them and having them think about it. And if they really want treatment, then, you know, I'm happy to offer it. But I think that's the key to make sure patients aren't disappointed is having appropriate patient expectations, just like we do in surgery. You know, we want that MAC off RD to have appropriate expectations, and we need the same thing for our dry AMD patients, which we're not used to doing in clinic as much.
I think that, Sarwar, that this is going to be one of those things where, like Priya said, it's, I do think I have some patients today, I think, who will stick with it because there are patients who they'll take anti-VEGF if they think it will make them better. Even if you know it will make them better, they still want to get anti-VEGF because they're just like, I will do anything. That's probably the target audience for this, given the sort of commitment. I mean, how are you going to manage, I guess, Sarwar, let's say you treated a patient and they had lost the follow-up, right? Like, how do you, that's not something we know from the trials. You don't have any marker. So let's say they disappear for 2 months or 3 months and then they come back. Do you keep going? Do you stop? Do you, like, let's say they're every 2 months and now it's 4 months. Do you go back to monthly? Like, we had all these rules in our head for wet AMD. Like, hey, if they have hemorrhage, I'm going to be more strict. And if they have more fluid, I'm going to be more strict. And now you have zero idea. You're just like, oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll go back to every other month. Or maybe come in and maybe injecting every 4 months is still better than nothing. Like, how do you think you'll manage situations where follow-up isn't what you planned?
Well, I mean, my hope is that, you know, I mean, we categorize our patients with, you know, DME, often in a different way to our AMD patients who have often have a slightly better follow-up track record. But this is where our colleagues are going to really help us out. I mean, you know, we don't know what the interval is going to be. I mean, I'm interested to see how people handle that. I mean, my instinct, I mean, I think we were talking about this earlier, is our instinct is there's some people who just treat and extend from visit 1. If you inject and there's no fluid for a wet AMD at the next visit, you go on to 5 weeks, you're going to 6 weeks. And, you know, for certain conditions, I've even started doing that, but we don't have a protocol for this. And I think, you know, I mean, I think you're right, Safa. I think it'll be really important to stick to protocol. My instinct would be to go back to protocol. You know, if we were doing monthly, we go back to monthly because we just don't know. You know, I mean, we don't know. I mean, is changing the frequency of interval, does that affect the risk of conversion to wet AMD? These are some things that we don't know. Regarding patient buy-in, I mean, I think what you were saying, Priya, about patient education is so important. There was a great article a few months ago in Retinal Physician that compared this conversation to the conversation about glaucoma care, where you are really trying to demonstrate to people, you know, what their vision would look like. And I think that's, you know, showing people their visual fields. I love the idea of showing people their autofluorescence and demonstrating the change in size. People respond really well to that. Sometimes if I want to inject someone that has PDR, but they don't see anything, then I show them the giant little crescent in their inferior retina of heme, then they say, oh snap, that doesn't look good. And that makes a difference. I still think, you know, that virtual reality idea of augmented, you know, goggles that help simulate what your level of vision loss is going to be is one of the best, you know, ways to demonstrate to people, this is what your vision to be, you know, like you won't be able to, you know, recognize faces. If we can recapitulate that, maybe, you know, I mean, obviously that applies to conditions like glaucoma as well. But I think patient education, as you mentioned, is huge. And our visual tools, I mean, we talk about autofluorescence, you know, it'll be interesting. We need to have a better standardization of that. You know, I mean, some of us have, like, for example, I have a Heidelberg, and the Heidelberg autofluorescence is outstanding. It's sort of the gold standard in all of our minds. But, you know, if I have an Optos, you know, so how, you know, we need good quantitative markers for that, a good macular image from an Optos autofluorescence. Those are different because, you know, it's a green autofluorescence versus a blue autofluorescence. So.
Yeah, that's good points. Sarwar has no disclosures for Heidelberg, I believe. He just loves it.
I don't at all.
Yeah. Safa, before we close this topic, any final thoughts like about the counseling, the follow-up? I mean, I had a guy, just throw another scenario, I had a guy today who he gets treatment for wet. Even though I'm not entirely sure he needs it, but he was getting treatment for wet before he moved to Miami. I've never seen him wet, and he is terrified of stopping injections because he said I was really wet before I started getting injections. And so he doesn't want to do that. But so I've like convinced him slowly to stretch out to 5 and then 6 and now like 7. Now he's like, I don't want to go past 7. 7 is my limit. But he also has a lot of atrophy, and I'm looking at him like, you're actually a good candidate for, and I talked to him for a while for this. And he's like, well, what I could do is I could get maybe the anti-VEGF on one day. He calls it VEGF. And then I can get the GA drug the other time. And I'll just alternate every month. I'll be here every month, doctor. And I'm just like, yeah, there's no data on that, but that seems reasonable. Like, what do you think about wet AMD patients who have atrophy? Like, how are we going to build that in? And I mean, we won't have data probably for a while.
I think the type of patient that you have is the rarity. You know, most patients, you know, trying to, you know, the more difficult ones are sometimes that I do every 2 weeks, you know, the Avastin Eylea wet that you do just for a little bit, just to kind of get over the hump. They're absolutely miserable. So for the regular patient monthly, I think for regular patients is going to be the most that they can do. So whether the staggered idea, you know, maybe one Eylea and the other, you know, the GA therapy, I think it's worth, you know, I wish there was data on it. There isn't, but it makes sense. It makes sense that that could potentially be a treatment regimen for somebody who's got, you know, GA that's creeping and also has CNB that just won't, you know, is not relenting. But it's going to be difficult. I think because I'm in a slow academic center, I have not tried it yet, but I've talked to a few patients. And I think, again, just like Priya said, giving a brochure, talking about it, let them go home, think about it, come back again. You can question them in terms of what they actually understood, you know, and it's critical because you see the understanding of what you thought you said versus what they're actually coming back to. So I think those are just going home, thinking about it, coming back and having multiple short conversations may actually be better than the long conversation, especially in the busy practices with like 60, 70 patients. You can't sit there for an hour, but you can say, hey, here's this brochure, go home, think about it, come back, we talk about it. Oh, here's another way to think about it. Go home. And within 2 to 3 months, you come up with a plan that works for the patient.
I like that. I like the idea of breaking it up because I think like we were alluding to, people can only absorb so much information at once and they're going to forget it. And I think that breaking it up and or having some good written materials that are useful. And I think the companies, to their credit, again, they have an incentive to do it, but they are creating these materials for patients to take home and read. And it's useful to sort of, you know, take advantage of that. You know, shifting gears a little bit, there's an article by Preeti Rao, Ed Wood, and Tamara Mahmood on the current status of subretinal delivery devices. I thought this was interesting, and I'm curious to get your guys' brief thoughts on this. It's a good read for anyone who's out there, just about the different ways you can sort of get into the subretinal suprachoroidal space. They talk about, like, you know, the subretinal cannulas we're used to, you know, 38 to even 48 gauge cannulas. That you can go trans retinal, but there are also sort of the ability to go trans scleral. There's also suprachoroidal cannulas that have been looked at, like the Orbit SDS device, which Novartis bought from Gyroscope. And then, you know, these different sort of abilities to get into the trans vitreal space via the sclera without doing a vitrectomy. All these are kind of interesting ideas because we just talked about all these GA patients. Safa, I mean, one of the big things is, yeah, this was great if it works, but the disadvantage, the reason it's different than glaucoma is they got to come in and get an injection every time you want to keep their GA from progressing. But if you could do something once that reduces their risk, well, that's great. That's a modifiable risk factor that you've affected, and that could be useful, especially if you could deliver it without having to do a surgery, or even better, without having to get into the vitreous cavity. You know, when you read about these devices, which of them is most exciting for you?
So I'm most scared of the suprachoroidal. That's the one that I'm most scared of. I've just seen too many things go wrong. So I think that's the one I'm most scared of.
So for the uninitiated out there, the students and residents who are listening, what bad things can happen?
You can have a lot of bleeding. Even when you think you've got it all, you can have a lot of bleeding. And the thing is, especially in the older patients, the scleros thinner, you can have ectasia that you don't really see easily. You know, in older patients, I've had to abort buccals because I get in there and the sclera is like a zebra, you know, so that's the one that I think in the general hands, I'm most afraid of in the complications. And then the other two, I think I just happen to have a lot more experience with, and I think it's just lends itself to less complications long-term and a little bit of an easier learning curve. So with no vitrectomy, going through the sclera and kind of being able to snake under the subretinal space is very exciting. I think that could be a possibility. I still would like to see more data about, you know, can that work without peeling the, you know, the vitreous and the posterior hyaloid in some of the younger patients? Because, you know, with the gene therapy trials, if you don't pull the posterior hyaloid, it's really hard to make the blebs beautifully. So it'll be interesting to see when people get started on these more long-term options. You know, just because you're not doing a vitrectomy doesn't mean that the hyaloid is not going to get in your way. So I think that's going to be a thing to test out, which sounds great in theory. It's just, I know from the gene therapy trials, the hyaloid can really be a hindrance in actually getting these really thin needles into the retina. So.
Yeah, I think it's an appropriate fear. I mean, I think agreeing with Sapastar, it's the hardest part about any potential space is your resistance. Any instrument's going to want to take the path of least resistance, and generally the path of least resistance is not a potential space, because its reason is called a potential space because it's not actually a space. It doesn't mean that it's not possible, and certainly people have access to supercritical space all the time, but you're absolutely right. You always want to think worst case scenarios are where that could end up in absolutely the wrong place. So I think one of the interesting things to think about with each device is, how are you sure when you're doing it that you're in the right spot? Similar to when you give a block, for example, you pull back to make sure you're not in the vessel. And that gives you some indication, hopefully you're in the right spot. But it is sort of a blind pass. So it'd be nice to have some sort of indicator or marker to know, hey, I am in the right place. And something a little more wieldy, then of course you could probably throw a B scan or something on it to look for your probe. There's gotta be maybe a better way to do that or visualize that in the office.
Yeah, no, I mean, I like the idea. I haven't done a suprachoroidal procedure. So my experience is limited to, you know, doing buccals and, you know, being freaked out by unexpected areas of scleral thinning. So similarly, I like the idea of nano subretinal gateway device. I think it sounds like a nice idea. And, you know, as I was reading this, I was thinking of other applications. I mean, it's, you know, the theory makes sense because, you know, they're, you know, I think in Japan, there's very limited vitrectomy that's done. And often, you know, you just peel the epiretinal membrane. And similar to what you said, Saf, I mean, injecting into the subretinal space is so much easier. I mean, if you peel the ILM, simply, you know, you can put your a soft tip cannula right at the surface and gentle aspiration without even barely touching the surface, and you can get transretinal egress or whatever subretinal fluid there is. But I started thinking that, you know, it may not be a bad idea. I mean, imagine if you have, you know, obviously subretinal hemorrhage is a unique example where, you know, you could consider injecting. You have easier access. You know you can put a certain amount of pressure with the tip of the needle and inject, for example, TPA. And the idea of possibly, you know, in doing a modified pneumatic in that situation is, you know, it sounds pretty exciting to me. But then, you know, I wonder, you know, I think about all these other applications of the subretinal needle, such as, you know, induced macular detachment. Imagine, you know, you have VMT. I mean, can you use the tip of the needle to, you know, to sever that connection? I mean, is that something that's possible while injecting subretinal BSS and then basically do a modified pneumatic? So it's exciting because I feel that the applications are, you know, our amazing colleagues are going to do some amazing things with this. So I'm looking forward to that. So that's something I can see myself using as soon as, you know, we have some more data.
You know, Bria, you can comment on this, but I'm going to throw in the last article since we're running over, that this has nothing to do with anything we're talking about except the fact it's about injections, but it's about antisepsis for injections. I thought it was fairly interesting because I'll tip my hand. I thought it was an interesting mix of data and then also just recommendations without data that are just standard of care from retina. I didn't disagree with those recommendations, but it's interesting because there's not actually data to support it. We just say this stuff because we feel like it's common sense. But they talk about, you know, injections, the types of flora that happen, and then, you know, with, you know, povidone iodine or betadine, like, does it matter how long it's there and what volume and what percentage? And I suggest anyone's interested, you can go read and go through that data. I think it's interesting. They talk about, you know, do you do one drop? Do you do two drops? Do you do it in 30 seconds? Do you do it in 3 minutes? And I thought that was more data-based, but then things sort of like, you know, patients shouldn't touch their eyes, you know, patients shouldn't rub their eyes, weren't really as data-based. It was just sort of like, oh, this is what we recommend. And that's probably because there is no data, because we don't go and randomize patients to rubbing or not rubbing. And then they talk about alternatives, right? People always talk about chlorhexidine or hypochlorous acid or other things that are kind of alternatives. You can tie this to the previous conversation on devices, or you can talk about either one. But anyway, you can take it off from there. I mean, I just think that it's interesting to think about antisepsis because infection is so rare anyway. But as we increase the volume of procedures, that's going to increase the number of people who get endophthalmitis. And I think it's interesting because I go to meetings and talk to people, and I feel like there's a whole diversity of what people do in terms of injection and infection prep. Some people risk stratify depending on how much bleph they see. Some people do a single drop because the patients die of SPK. If you flush their whole eye with, especially their bilateral injections that we're talking about, they can't see for a couple of days afterward. What are your thoughts after reading this article? And you can also add anything you thought about the previous article with the devices.
Yeah, so I thought this article was a really great summary of the different steps to antisepsis and different processes. You know, I think it's nice to think about alternatives to povidone iodine. And I know this is going to sound really crazy, but I encourage all the listeners to go put a drop of betadine in your eyes and just see how it feels. It's terrible.
Don't do that, listeners. Don't listen to her.
Maybe put preparacaine in first, but it's terrible. It's awful. And I think
we have really, really like influenceable listeners. They're going to go do this.
Okay. Don't put a drop of povidone iodine in your eyes. I'll take that
it
back.
It was a figure of speech.
Figure of speech. But
in some country.
But it's, you know, sometimes when we, you see these doctors drop like a bottle of betadine in patients' eyes, and you know, you kind of realize why they're so uncomfortable. And so I think it's important to think of alternatives. And I think it's going to be more important because our dry AMD patients with atrophy are all much older on average. They're going to need to come in with monthly injections, and they're never going to do the injections if the injections are terrible. And remember, they're not getting better vision and they're not really noticing a change. So I think patient comfort with injections is becoming more and more important. The reason I like this paper is it does, you know, reiterate some of the things we already know, like dilute povidone iodine is thought to be the same as normal povidone iodine. It kind of reinforces the need to have it sit for a little bit for adequate antisepsis, and then talks about chlorhexidine, which I know many practices are now using for primary prevention.
Yeah. I think, you know, I saw Safak sort of nodding when I was talking about the volume end up going up. It's interesting because I think there's very few studies that have shown a meaningful difference in endophthalmitis, and it's probably because it's just a low rate event. And I think that's why we have such diverse trends about things like masking and gloves and, again, speculum versus lid holding, because I think, thankfully, most of us can count on one hand the number of patients who have had endophthalmitis from an injection we've given. And unless you start getting a run of them, you really don't start questioning. You go through the depression and think about it, and you're like, okay, like it happens, but it's a rare event. Would you change any of your practice patterns after reading this, Safa? Anything that you think is, or reinforce anything that you do that other people don't do?
So I actually am the person who will put one drop after the injection. And it's impressive how much egress you see on the older patients because they have such a liquefied vitreous. You'll see fluids just like pouring out of the injection site. So it makes me feel better to put one drop after. So I put, you know, the one drop before and prep. And then when the technician does that, and then when I start, I put one more drop, inject, and then one drop after. And I've noticed that the key for my patient's comfort is really washing the betadine out afterwards. So the technicians really spend a lot of time washing the eye to try to get it all out. And then for my really old patients with with dry eye. I do give ointment, and that seems to help the first night. So either Gentil or Erythromycin, that seems to help kind of mitigate the irritation from the pain. I have put betadine in my eye. It is very irritating, but I rather have that than infection. So I try to, you know, prep my patients that, hey, if you're irritated, I'm trying to prevent a catastrophic event. So bear with me. And they, for the most part, understand.
Yeah. Sarwar, are you team betadine?
I am definitely team betadine. Absolutely. I thought this article was great in the sense that, you know, I talk to my, you know, like we all talk to our colleagues, we all do something a little bit different. And you're like, wait, really? You don't do that? So I actually, in my fellowship, we prep the lashes with 10% betadine. So my usual protocol is, you know, I put a drop of proparacaine in. I don't have anyone set up the injections for me at this point. I just have a tray set up. And I put a drop of betadine, and right after the patient stops their initial shock, because it's so uncomfortable, as we talked about, I do my subconj, and then I prep them, and then I prep the lashes, and then I make the get the medication ready. I also do a drop at the end, and I think it's interesting because this article actually reinforced a lot of the things that I do that I thought I was like, oh, I'm way too overkill. So I don't know if it was necessarily the best article for me because it reinforced my habits. That's probably make me a little less efficient. But it's interesting. I mean, one thing that my big takeaway from this article is we can probably go with a more dilute betadine. The interesting thing is, you know, there aren't any good formulations of betadine that, and unless you dilute it yourself, you know, and we have to be very careful with the shelf life of that. You know, and someone has to prepare that for you. The other thing is, you know, that I took away is I also do a very vigorous washout of the betadine at the end of the injection. And then this article specifically says, too aggressive of a washout can dislodge bacteria. And I'm like, I literally wrote, bruh, come on, man. Like, patient, you know, and that's what patients really hate. So I think, you know, if we have 5% is great. One change I may make is, I mean, the 10% is something that we use in all this in the initial studies. It was 10% betadine and 10% on the injection site prior to injection. But we can probably go with lower concentrations, even probably for the lashes, because if some of that 10% betadine gets, the more dilute the betadine, the more irritation it causes. So I think, you know, this may be a place where industry can step in to have create formulations. I mean, you know, I'm happy to mix the betadine myself and have something that I use for a day or two, but, you know, I'd worry about how sort of preservative free that is, you know, and policing that myself, I'd be a bit concerned about. But possibly if we had one of our industry partners create a slightly more dilute form of betadine, that's something I think I certainly would utilize.
I think that, you know what I want to see data on that no one showed here? Anyone soak a Q-tip in betadine and put it on the site they're going to inject? So I have patients who will absolutely, I have a couple patients who get anaphylaxis with the betadine, like real anaphylaxis, or they break out in hives. But then you're like, okay, use something else. So I tried chlorhexidine. And then they were very careful. Like, I want to try one drop. So put one drop on their skin, they broke out in hives. And I tried Vigamox and they broke out in hives. These are all on different days. So around like once a week for like a month, we tried Vigamox, they got hives. We tried Polytrim, they got hives. We tried gentamicin, they got hives. And so at the end, we were like, you know, we either go bare, which is not a good idea, or maybe you take a Benadryl before you come and we watch you, and maybe you just put a very focal amount. So I started doing this where I soak a Q-tip in betadine. I put it focally on the site. She still gets hives, but she doesn't, like, her throat doesn't close up and she does fine. And I have no idea if that's going to work because no one's ever like looked to see if it actually kills the bacteria in that area. But I will sit there for like a whole minute holding it in the site I'm going to inject, and then I'll inject right after and pray that it was enough. With the idea that the lids are retracted and there's nothing contacting that area again. But this goes back to your point, Sarah, that all of us made. Every single one of us does something different. And that's not good when it comes to something that's an infection prevention protocol. But it goes back to low numbers too. What about, last thing before we go, what do you guys tell your patients about showering?
Oh my God. So I don't know what it is with patients. I'm sorry. I have very strong opinions about that. I have my whole spiel. It's like
about showering or about which
just
part
about
of
putting
this?
Water in the eyes. I tell people you can shower, but don't, you know, don't get any water in the eyes. I don't know what it is. You know, I don't know if patients hear this, like y'all need to stop putting water in your eyes. Tap water does not belong in the eyes. I had a patient, I'm convinced she went to, a third world country, back to her, motherland, and she developed, a really bad panophthalmitis involvement in both eyes. And I know, it's common. People like putting water in their eyes. It feels good. But I actually have started telling people, it's like, whenever people are like, oh, I can't put water in my eyes. What? It's like, why are you putting water in your eyes? You put it through a filter. We all have these Brita filters. So, I tell patients, use a clean tissue. Don't blow your nose and then put it on your eye. I just say 24 hours, no water in the eyes. And it's interesting. I have a lot of Muslim patients. And when I tell them, don't put any water in the eyes, because during the preparation for prayer, there's a certain ritual, you wash the face. So, I have to be very careful. And, thankfully the patients are receptive. It's like from one Muslim to another, man, y'all got to listen to me. Don't put any water in your eyes.
Safa, do you have thoughts on Sarwar invoking religion in his, I don't know what to say. I'm going to be careful. I'm going to stay away from this.
It's okay. I'm Muslim too, so it works out.
I know. That's why I asked you.
I'm more lean. I think people understand, like, shower from the neck down, don't get any any dirty soapy water around the eyes. And people seem to understand that. I think if I say regular shower, separating those things are hard. So I always say shower from the neck down for 24 hours. And that seems to be more, there seems to be more understanding of what that means. And kind of following through, but I don't tell them anything else, because I feel like if I nitpick more, then they'll perseverate more. So I try not to do that. So, but this article really reinstated, as Sawar said, I do a ton of the antiseptic protocols, and it just, I thought a lot of it was just voodoo. So it just reinstated my crazy. It didn't help.
There is data for 5% betadine at the end of vitrectomy. I started doing that, and I just have some betadine at the end, that I just put the 5% from the prep that I just put into on the eye after all the wounds are closed. And there are some data from Japan about the efficacy of that, slightly low infection rates. The other thing is that I took away is I think we're all creatures of habit. In all the places I operate, we soak the buckle in gentamicin. It's like, oh, you want to soak it in gentamicin? I'm like, yeah, sure. Is that what everyone does? Sure, no problem. But we can just use the betadine that we use for the prep.
Are you advocating brown buckling?
I guess so.
White buckles should be able to come in all colors. I agree. It's be good to have a brown buckle, I guess. I'm curious, how does your cornea look the next day? So you put a drop of betadine, you put a patch on their eye, and then how does that cornea look the next day?
It actually looks okay. I mean, I clean the area with a wet and dry, and then I put the post-op drops in right before I close. And a lot of the post-op drops actually, basically dilute it a little bit. It's 5%, okay. So it works a little bit. But the cornea actually looks okay the day after.
Priya, final vote. Do you believe in brown buckles or clear buckles?
Yeah, I do like soaking my buckle in betadine. It makes it easier to thread. I think
that's do you that, really?
I think it makes it easier. I do belt loops.
This is a thing? How did I not know about this?
Well, I do still get belt loops. Yeah, I do belt loops, and it's easy. It just makes it a little slipper. It makes it more slippery.
Are brown surgeons more likely statistically to do this? Because on this podcast, I feel like that's definitely the trend.
Maybe we should.
I don't soak my buckle in anything. So I don't want gentamicin anywhere in my eyes.
Interesting. So you just have it sitting.
Yeah, I dip it in saline right before I put it. I don't open it until I need it, because the whole, putting buckle in, antibiotics was from when we had sponges and, more porous material. So right now I use silicone only, and it's non-porous. So I don't have them open until I'm literally ready to take it. So it's not sitting out in open air.
Yeah.
So open it right when I'm about to snake it in. I dip it in a little bit of BSS and it snakes right in.
We need a study. I think this is a really easy study. If you're a student or resident out there, I'm not going to do this study so someone can poach it. I think someone should do a study where they randomize any patient getting a buckle or buckle bit. And at the end of the surgery, before you close the conge, take a cotton tip and swab under the conge all the way around. Like, do like a swab, like you're swabbing the fornix, but in the subconge space, and just plate it and see. And you would compare saline versus gent versus betadine. And I'm just curious, because clinically we don't see a difference because it's super rare to have like a buccal infection early on, right? But it'd be really curious, like, is the flora different whether with what you're doing or not? That's a really easy, like, I'm sure now with the way middle schoolers are, it's like a middle schooler project for science fair too. But it's also like a first author publication and like a big journal. So it's both at the same time. If you have a 12-year-old in school who needs a project.
A great project for like an academic center that does a lot of buccal vits. I mean, I know a lot of people that do straight up buccal vits for all fake RDs, and that would be very quick to do.
Yeah. It'd be like a day at one place, just like do 10 of those and just you'd be down for the day. Guys, I really appreciate taking the time, being generous. Safa, Priya, Sarwar, great talking to you. Looking forward to seeing you all at VBS in a couple weeks. And thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having us, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Many thanks to Drs. Rahmani, Vakaria, and Zahid for joining me for this podcast episode. Listeners, thank you for all that you do. Thank you for listening. Remember, you can find all 385 of our episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All episodes are there and sorted by category, easily archived for your listening pleasure. Remember, you can subscribe for the latest episode updates by inputting your email on our website. Find us on social media, on Facebook and on Twitter, at RetinaPodcast. Remember, we love ideas. We have a whole slew of calendar coming up based on listener and ideas. We got patients write in with ideas. So keep that in mind. You know, this is a wonderful opportunity. If you do have something you want to get out in the community, let us know. We'll see if it fits in with the schedule. Thank you again to our entire production team. That includes Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, Mike Nicasa, and Justin Ma. And again, listeners, thank you for all you do. Patients you take care of, articles are being published, patients you inspire here. Our next episode will be coming out next week. I'll be seeing many of you at the Bit Buccal Society annual meeting in Las Vegas. For those of you attending, don't feel shy. Come and say hi, and look forward to seeing you all there. And if not, we'll be back with that episode next week. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.